to spend the time talking with you about here this afternoon is a topic that is always a fascinating one for readers and for students of Bible prophecy. It deals with the subject of the King of the South, the coming clash of civilizations, as we turn our focus and attention to a part of the world that is, again, the focal point of Bible prophecy, which is the Middle East. Now, this particular map here shows a kind of an overview of a region of the world that is a very critical strategic region for all of the world at this time because of the religious events that are taking place there, the rise of Islam in our time, in our period, especially the radical Islamist elements that originate in that part of the world and make their impact around the world as they have. It is also a strategic area in terms of oil and resources, as I'll touch on and as we move through this subject here, because of the reserves of oil that are in nations such as Iraq and Iran, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the Arab states there, and our dependence in the West on those energy supplies. So this is a critical region that has seen so many different wars over the centuries, but especially in our own time, within the last 60 years, especially if we take 1948 as the beginning of the State of Israel, when it came into existence, and the conflicts that have raged back and forth between the Jews and the Israelis and the Palestinians and the Arab world, and the wars that have been fought there, and the attempts to bring peace, which are an ongoing measure and effort and situation there. We have a very, very volatile part of the world that demands and draws world attention there on an ongoing basis and has foiled the best efforts to bring about peace and security to that part of the world. Some of you have probably traveled there for various reasons, whether for business or pleasure or as part of even our own church experience where we've held Feast of Tabernacles in the Middle East. And if you've had the opportunity to travel there, you recognize that it is a different part of the world. It's a fascinating part of the world. It is. I've made three trips over there in my lifetime, and I've never felt threatened. I've always felt comfortable, despite the turmoil that we have there. But it is a fascinating place to visit, to study, and certainly when it comes to Bible prophecy. I'd like to turn our attention to the book of Daniel, and you can go ahead and turn there. I've put many of the scriptures for this presentation on, but this one I chose just to leave off. In Daniel 11, we have the longest prophecy in the Bible, and I'm not going to go through all of that, obviously, this afternoon. We won't have time for that. But in this long prophecy, where Daniel begins to gain some detailed understanding of the history of this region from his time forward to the very time of our period and that preceding the return of Jesus Christ, Daniel turns his attention in verse 5 of Daniel 11 to what is called here two individuals that are termed the King of the South. In verse 5 of Daniel 11, he says, "The King of the South shall become strong as well as one of his princes, and he shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. And at the end of some years, they shall join forces, for the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the power of authority, and neither he nor his authority shall stand. But she shall be given up with those who brought her, and with him who begot her, and with him who strengthened her in these times." Now, what this long prophecy is really describing and talking about, many good commentaries go into the historical details. So we have done this in some of our literature as well. Our booklet, The Middle East in Prophecy, gives a brief overview of some of the historical background here. I just wanted to read that from the perspective of establishing that these two entities that move through this story in Daniel 11 are the King of the South and the King of the North. And we're going to focus on the King of the South, but we're also going to be—we need to be aware of the King of the North in this particular prophecy and how it plays out. These two entities, the King of the North and the King of the South, sprung out of the division of the empire of Alexander the Great after his death. Those of you that know remember your history and know how that impacted this part of the world, this map and the part that is in red represents the four regions out of the empire conquered by Alexander the Great that were divided among his four generals at his death. And the two that we are most interested in are the two that began to take this biblical name of the King of the North and the King of the South. The King of the North was the area that was reigned over by one of Alexander's generals named Seleucus, and his particular region is what is in modern-day Syria, in this area right up here along the coast, the eastern coast of the Mediterranean Sea. There was another general named Ptolemy of Alexander's generals. The region he was given is the area down here that we now know essentially as Egypt and the Sudan and Ethiopia goes down to the south. But the city of Alexandria that Alexander the Great himself founded became the seat of that particular part of the empire. And the Ptolemies became, in this biblical terminology, the king of the south. The Roman Empire eventually succeeded the Empire of Alexander as the wars and the fightings and the squabblings between not only these generals but their descendants over a few hundred years. And then along came the rise of the Roman Empire. And Rome came down into this region and, of course, conquered this area and eventually took over the area of the Seleucid Empire. And as far as Bible terminology and reckoning is concerned, when Rome took over this area of the King of the North that is described here, it became the King of the North. There remained, however, the Ptolemaic Empire, the King of the South, and of Alexander's, those empires that came out of the Alexandrian Empire, I think that the empire of the Ptolemies probably lasted the longest. The last reigning monarch of the Ptolemaic Empire was Cleopatra. We all probably remember that name from history, as well as the movie that was made by, several times, but Elizabeth Taylor, probably the most famous Cleopatra of all times. She was the last of the kings of the South, in reality. You can call her a queen of the South, but she was the last one, because Rome eventually took over the area of Egypt in the third decade of the BC, I think it's 33 BC, 34 BC, and it ceased to be an autonomous region. And so this king of the South then originated in this area of Egypt. Rome became the king of the North. And, of course, the Roman Empire became what it did, and it lasted until 476 A.D. with the fall of the city of Rome as the traditional date for the fall of the Roman Empire. And, of course, it was divided into an eastern and western region as well. Now, without going into all the details of the history of this region, obviously we have during this period of time, from the time of the last King of the South, the Roman period, we certainly had the events of the New Testament, the birth of Jesus Christ, the founding of the church, and the rise of the church, and the spread of the church through the empire during that period of time. And then the Roman Empire existed for roughly another four centuries, until it declined, at least in the West. It, however, continued in the East with a capital at Constantinople. And the story of the region, as far as we are concerned, really kind of goes into kind of a backwater until we come to a series of events that surround the man that we know from history as the prophet Muhammad. In the early 7th century A.D., Muhammad begins to see have his visions, and he begins to found the religion of Islam that we know today. And at his death in the year 632 AD, Islam begins to make a leap out of the deserts of Arabia and spread throughout the Mediterranean area, conquering various nations and beginning to grow and to develop. And of course, we still obviously have the story of Islam that has developed and with us to this day. But if you look at this map, you see the region that was essentially conquered by the armies of the various caliphs and the spread of Islam out of the Arabian Peninsula, through North Africa, up into what was the old Persian Empire and areas of modern-day Iraq and Iran, through the Gulf states down here, the modern Gulf states. And, of course, it eventually spread across North Africa. And you see through these maps that it jumped across the Straits of Gibraltar, the Mediterranean, and had a very dominating presence in Spain. What is interesting to note about this map, and I thought it was a good one to at least illustrate a couple of things, is certainly the spread of Islam during the century or more after the death of Muhammad and what took place. If you'll notice this purple section right in here, this represents the Byzantine Empire. This is the eastern part of the Roman Empire. Byzantium is not always something that we know that much about or study that much about. It's a fascinating part of the story of the Roman Empire, because after the city of Rome fell in the west, Byzantine Empire and the city of Constantinople existed for another 1,000 years, essentially, until the latter part of the 1400s, when the Turks and the Arabs finally conquered the city of Constantinople, or as it had become, Istanbul. And one of the reasons, of course, it endured during this period of time, but if you just look at this map, it's very instructive, because as Islam came out of the deserts of Arabia and conquering this part of their world, and then they came up against Constantinople, and they could not breach the walls of Constantinople and defeat that part of the Roman Empire, the eastern part, at that period of time. Because of the strength of the walls, the strength of the armies, and the political system there, essentially Islam had to divert around and through North Africa and come into Europe through Spain for that period of time. And that, in one sense, can be understood because of the strength of the Byzantine Empire for that period of time. And Islam pushed, if you will, to use that term, against the North, and the understanding the King of the North as a European-based empire and the successors of Rome. But what happened was it had to spread around this way. Now, within 100 years, in fact, to the very year, 732 A.D., after the 100 years after Muhammad's death, Islam had spread all the way up into what is modern-day Spain and were encroaching upon France, and there was a battle fought at a place called Tours. The general, or the, let's call him a German leader, was a man, a Frankish leader. His name was Charles Martel. He defeated the armies of Islam at a place called Tours in the year 732 AD. Charles Martel stopped the Islamic advance into Europe as early as 732. Charles Martel was the grandfather of the man that we know from history as Charlemagne, Charles the Great, who founded the Holy Roman Empire. But so as early as 732, you had a push, if I can say, by a power coming out of the south into Europe that was defeated. Now, there was another effort. Mr. Weber alluded to it this morning, in the late 1600s, after the armies of Islam defeated Constantinople and then began to spread through this area. They came up against the gates of Vienna in the late 1600s, and they were stopped there as well. And I bring this out just to show you from two historical markers that the armies of Islam have come out of this region in the past at least twice and pushed against the King of the North, or Europe. But they were both times they were stopped. The Holy Roman Empire and European civilization never did come under the domination of Islam, except here in Spain, where you can still see the remnants of their civilization in Cordoba and other places. But they were stopped on two occasions, and the Holy Roman Empire ran its history from the time of Charlemagne down to the time of Napoleon. And that part of the story of the King of the North, if you will, and how that ties into Bible prophecy. And so when we look at this, it's important to understand that we look here in Daniel about the King of the South pushing at the King of the North. Understand, as Mr. Weber was saying this morning, that in terms of prophecy, at times these things are layered. And with each layering of events, we move a step closer to the final fulfillment of what the Bible is talking about in some of these events. And so keep that in mind from that perspective as we move around. Now, this particular slide will show the influence, or where Islam is around the world today. This essentially shows you an arc stretching from the Mediterranean coast of Africa all the way across North and even Central Africa, through the Middle East, on down into the area of Asia. And some of the biggest populations of Islamic nations are in Malaysia, right down in here today. You see a large red circle there. This is the Malaysia is the largest concentration of Islam of any of the other nations. But you see this arc ascending through this entire region today. This shows about 1.3 billion members of the Islamic faith as they exist and occupy that part of the world. So when we are looking at this prophecy in Daniel, and we're trying to understand what it means and where it means, when we discuss the fact that this king of the south is going to make this advance or this push from this region south of Jerusalem, and as our biblical marker point, it's easy to understand not only from a historical perspective, but also from just a geographic and demographic perspective today, how this is possible and why and how this is going to take place when we look for that to come out of this particular region in whatever form and fashion it will eventually take itself going forward. Now let's go back to Daniel 11. I've got it up on the board for you here, so you can follow along. Beginning in verse 40, we move in the time frame of Daniel's story to the time of the end, as verse 40 says. And so we are moving into this period through history, through hundreds of years of historical experience, down to this period of time when the story of the king of the north and the king of the south and their work back and forth comes to a concluding point here beginning in verse 40, where it says, "At the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him." And this is speaking of pushing at the king of the north and making this attack, this action of aggression in whatever form and fashion that it will be. "And the king of the north shall come against him," meaning the king of the south, "like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships." Now, in the language that Daniel was using here, chariots and horsemen, ships, obviously armaments of a military and a great military strike that we're not going to talk about chariots and horsemen today, but obviously we have our modern counterpoints that represent the instruments of war for a modern military nation. So this sets us up for an event at the time of the end where the king of the south will push at him and make this effort. Now, this particular map that I made up here shows the configuration of Islam coming up out of the south from within this region and making a push against a European-based power that is identified in Bible prophecy as the King of the North. And a final representation from the book of Revelation chapter 17 of a woman riding a beast with horns and heads as Revelation 17 describes in this final revival of a system that has existed since the time of Rome and is a final in time modern resurrection of the Roman Empire. And this push will come in some form and fashion against them, and then they will make a push against the king of the south. The king of the north will come at him, as the prophecy here in Daniel 11:40 begins to say, where this power will come in out of that north into this particular region. Now, let's pause for a moment and ask why and how and what possibly could be the factors that would cause this. We're talking here in terms of modern needs and situations. If we look at this power of the King of the North coming out of a European-based confederation of nations, the Bible talks in Revelation 17 about 10 kings giving their power to the beast for a period of time, and I'm not going to have the time to go into all of that and explain it. That's another presentation in itself. But that being who we are discussing, and if the form of the European Union today eventually evolves to a form to fulfill those particular parameters of 10 kings giving their power to one leader in a church-state combination that feels threatened, has been pushed at, has had some form of aggression, and feels threatened to the point where they have to make an advance for whatever reason to protect their economies, to protect their status, to protect the peace of the world, to protect the ongoing global commerce of the world as the power chosen, designated, or decided to be the protector of the peace and the stability of the global system as it is at that particular time. What is it that could be a factor to cause that? Well, let's look at what we have today when we look in Europe and their current energy situation. The European Union today, like every other modern power, moves forward on oil and natural gas, just like Canada, just like the United States and every developed nation. Without it, any modern nation grinds to a halt. We would, you would, we would park our cars, our industries would come to a grinding halt, our economies would come to a crash if somehow, some way, our energy supplies were cut off from the sources that we have. In Europe, their consumption grows 1 to 2% each year. The European Union imports 76% of the oil that it currently consumes. 76% of their oil is imported from various places, and the majority of it comes from the Middle East. They use 15 million barrels of oil a day. 15 million a day, and 50% of that imported oil comes out of the Persian Gulf. 50% of it. They have a very heavy reliance upon the oil coming out of the Persian Gulf area. 40% of its natural gas that it consumes is imported as well. 40%. A few years ago, I think it's what, 2 to 3 years ago now, in the midst of a very cold winter, Russia cut off their supplies or began to diminish the supply of natural gas going into Europe. Parts of the place got very cold for a period of time. Russia was kind of flexing their economic muscle and their newfound ability to influence or to at least cause a bit of trouble, but it is because of their vast resources of natural gas and Europe's dependency upon the natural gas resources that they have. In the year 2030, Europe's energy needs are going to only increase. As their population grows and their needs and their demands grow, it is expected by those that calculate out into the future on these issues that the European Union will import 90% of the oil that it uses by the year 2030. That's, again, very heavy reliance on the oil, as well as 80% of its natural gas needs having to be imported as well. Now, the question comes, who's going to provide this? Who is going to deliver the oil and the gas for the European Union? Well, it's going to be the area of the world that we've been talking about, which are its members form a significant section of what we call OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, who are mainly within the Persian Gulf. Gas and oil also for Europe is going to come from Russia, but the majority of the supplies for Europe are going to come out of the Persian Gulf countries. 40% of the oil comes out of the Persian Gulf. That is 40% of the European Union oil comes out of the Persian Gulf. So you again see the heavy reliance that Europe has on this part of the world. And these particular nations here that this map show are some of the heaviest oil-producing countries of the Middle East. You've got Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait right here, and then the Gulf states down here in the Persian Gulf. This is an area of the world. Obviously, these are all OPEC nations. They don't constitute all that are OPEC, but they are very important nations because 57% of the proven oil reserves worldwide are found in these Persian Gulf OPEC countries that are shown here, this dark section of this map. 57% of proven oil reserves worldwide are found here. Now, as time goes along and the oil supplies are depleted, this margin between the Persian Gulf countries and other nations is only going to grow wider. They're still going to have a predominantly large share of the proven oil reserves coming out of this region. So you see the reliance that America, and particularly the European Union for our story here today, are going to have upon this part of the world. It is a remarkable story and need that is developing. By 2030, Europe will be importing at least 70% of its natural gas. Who's going to make up the gap? Well, it's going to have to come from other nations, and it's going to come primarily out of this part of the Persian Gulf that we look at in this map of these countries that are where the largest reserves are. So with that as a background, perhaps that gives us a little bit of an understanding as to why and perhaps how this push from this king of the south will begin to develop as this interdependency and these needs of the world's largest market, in Europe, which the European Union is. Some people are saying now that the European Union, with its expansion now, I think, 27 nations form the European Union as it is today, that is the world's largest market. And it's only going to grow. They're going to continue to probably add additional nations, and they will also continue to grow and to develop because of the nature of markets, and also because of what we understand in terms of prophecy. Now, without going into all of that, again, this current European Union is probably going to go through some evolution and some changes to come to a configuration that we read about in prophecy, especially when we look at the specific reference to 10 kings giving their power to the beast for a short period of time. But again, that's another presentation or another story there. But nonetheless, you're talking about a region that is going to have a very large reliance upon the Middle East or oil-producing nations, and any effort to cut that supply or to work with it or tinker with it in some way is going to be seen, obviously, as a threat to Europe. That is just focusing upon the economic issue. We're not even having touched upon the religious issue. Europe today has a very high percentage of Islamic citizens in various countries living there, and it is growing, outpacing in terms of growth some of the native inhabitants of like France or the Netherlands, and so their population is growing there, and they are having a very continuing to grow religious influence and impact upon the society of many of these European countries, and that in itself is creating other issues. I'll talk about that in my second presentation this afternoon. But that, combined with the oil and the needs there, create a very volatile mix of situations. Now, let's go back to Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40. As we talk about this king of the north coming into this part of the world, Daniel says that he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. He shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. And he goes on in verse 41 to say that, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. So at this part of the prophecy, some of these specific countries begin to be mentioned, and the fact that three of them here are mentioned, that they escape out of the hand of this king of the north as it begins to come into this part of the world. Now, this map here shows you that region of Edom, Moab, and the chief of the children of Ammon, which is essentially, as we're talking about, the modern nation of Jordan, the Hashemite kingdom of Jordan. The capital of Jordan is Ammon, taken from the very children of Ammon. And Edom and Moab anciently existed in this area, in the southern part of modern Jordan. So the prophecy tells us, for whatever reason, that this part of the Middle East somehow escapes the dominating influence or hand of this king of the north as it rushes into this part of the world. It's an interesting story to think about and to speculate about. Jordan is a fascinating country, and we've had an interesting relationship in terms of our church experience with the country of Jordan, and we still have a ongoing projects over there that we have begun to work with, and we have a feast site there every 2 to 3 years. And has anyone here ever been to the feast in Jordan and attended there? It's a fascinating experience. I highly recommend it. In the future, the next one is scheduled to be in 2010. But if you have an opportunity, it is a fabulous trip, and you see a lot of the Bible lands there in that part of the Middle East as well, and just an interesting, fascinating country to visit. Now, in Daniel 11, verse 42, to pick up the story, as this king of the north comes in, it says that he shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. And so, we see that specifically three countries are mentioned here. Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia do not escape. They are come under the influence and the control of this king of the north as he comes into this region and works his way through. Now, in verse 43, going back, he shall have power over the hidden treasures of gold and of silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. So again, another reference is made to Egypt, and gold and silver and the precious things are mentioned as to what he has control over in this part of the world. Now, you know, the terminology of gold and precious things refer obviously to a very valuable metal and precious metals. But I think we can also adapt or understand oil as a form of gold in terms of the modern needs and the influence and the precious factor of oil in our modern world. That gold or oil, which has been called in the past black gold, for those of you that watched the Beverly Hillbillies, you remember that when Jed missed that day, up came that bubbling crude black gold. So can we understand this verse in regard to the resources of oil that are there and natural gas as well as being something that is being discussed in this particular prophecy that is a part of what drives and fuels, to use that term, this push and this reaction into this part of the world? We're looking at the economic factors here. I think that it's not beyond the realm of possibility to understand it in that particular way. Now, Daniel 11, verse 44 goes on to say that tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore, he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. And he shall plant, it says, the tabernacles of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. So these events are going to move quite rapidly once they are initiated, and it's going to set off events that the Bible talks about at this particular period of time. But the focus, once again, is going to be in this glorious holy mountain, which is a reference to Jerusalem, and this particular spot right here, which is the focal point of all of Bible prophecy and attention of Jerusalem, and is going to continue to see more and more attention from the world's nations as we move toward the fulfillment of these events. But this specific prophecy talks about various tidings coming out of north and northern and eastern section out of Jerusalem. Now, this gives you the direction going into Russia, which is again a major energy exporting nation today, and the needs that are there on in toward the area of Asia and China, that begin to set up a prophecy and events that the book of Revelation talks about here at the sounding of the sixth angel back in Revelation 9 and verse 13, where it says, the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar which is before God, saying to the sixth angel who had, before God, saying to the sixth angel who had the trumpet, release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates. Now, the river Euphrates is what runs right through modern-day Iraq, and we have this geographic marker here through this prophecy of the Euphrates River and powers that are to the beyond that, to the east of it. In verse 15, it says, so the four angels who had been prepared for the hour and day and month and year were released to kill a third of mankind. And then in verse 16, it says, the number of the army of the horsemen was 200 million, and I heard the number of them. And so a vast army of great size, mentioned here as 200 million, begins to assemble from the nations east of the Euphrates, which again gets us into the area of Russia and China and the Asian nations, where the earlier map showed you was a very high concentration of Islamic countries and population, that for the reasons that we've talked about, plus other reasons such as religion, and we haven't even touched on the matter of spiritual deception that will grip the world at this time, marshals and brings together armies and powers pouring into this part of the world. And then it goes on to talk about the sixth angel pouring out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and the water was dried up so that the way of the kings from the east might be prepared. And so we see, as this map shows then, that kings of the east come across the area of the Euphrates River and come once again focusing into the area of the Middle East and the Holy Land, the glorious land, and Jerusalem being the center of these prophecies and these armies that will gather there during this particular period of time. So in looking at what we have and see described here, we see some possibilities that energy needs are going to keep the Middle East as a focus of attention. No question about that in the days, months, and years ahead, and it's going to have its impact upon the modern world and especially that of Europe. And that religion will not be the only reason, probably, for the conflicts in this region that create this king of the south pushing at the king of the north. When we go back to this region and look at it, again, the historical perspective here, there's been a long-standing desire within the Arab world to come together and to unite all of the various nations that are a part of the Islamic community, the Ummah, as it is called, under one leader. In the late 1800s, there was a leader that arose in the Sudan, there south of Egypt, called the Mahdi. And he rallied the forces and claimed to be the leader and tried to unite the tribes. And he incurred the wrath of the Roman Empire. I'm not the Roman Empire, but the British Empire at that time. And they came down in the famous area of Khartoum and General Gordon. And that story, Gordon was killed by the Mahdi. But this particular individual met his own death. He did not succeed in uniting all of the Arab world. But they have long looked for a leader. In our own time, in the 1950s, a man by the name of Gamal Abdel Nasser arose in Egypt, and he attempted to unite the Arab nations in a united Arab republic, and under his leadership for a period of time, he dominated the Arab world. When I was a kid growing up, it was Nasser that was the prime focus of the Middle Eastern world and the leader of that period. In our own time right now, we look at Osama bin Laden and his attempts, and certainly he's made some strikes against the United States and other countries as an individual who has sought to, again, bring together the Arab world under one leader to promote Islam and to strike at the West and the infidel and to destroy the modern world, which they see as a threat. And so we have seen these faces come and go, and we look at this one today, and we still, at least, we look for his capture here and wonder if that might yet happen and what his fate might be. Time will tell on that. We've also got another individual that we look at on the world scene today, and this is the president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who has made some very severe threats against the West and the state of Israel in particular. He is unashamed in his hatred of the Jews and his desire to bring the world into a final conflagration that will usher in the appearance of the so-called hidden imam, this Mahdi-type character that will unite all of Islam in the time of the end and usher in their version of utopia. But it will only be as a result, after a very bloody period of time, that they could initiate. And he is a very religious man in his own way and what he feels, and he has made a lot of headlines, at least, in the last 2.5 years since he's been the president of Iran. He is an interesting figure. He may very well pass from the scene and someone else come on. I just put that up there for us to consider the needs that we have. If we turn our attention to Egypt, which is a very interesting situation, remember that Egypt seems to be a focus of the prophecy in Daniel 11. for whatever reason. Egypt has probably the largest standing Muslim army or army within the Arab world. It is the largest Arab nation. And it has been ruled since, 1982 by President Hosni Mubarak, who is about 81 or 82 years of age now and in declining health. He has been grooming his son Jamal down here to be his successor, but he, since the assassination of Anwar Sadat, Mubarak has been the man on the scene. And, of course, Egypt has been a very strong ally of America since the Camp David peace accords. And it's interesting, I just put President Bush's picture up there with him because America has had a very strong association with Egypt. And in the last years of the Mubarak regime, there has been a great deal of unrest in Egypt. There is a group of people called the Muslim Brotherhood who have made some inroads into popular society. And should this, when Mubarak passes from the scene, there's going to be a time of transition in Egypt, and there is a very, very strong, virulent form of Islamic radicalism in Egyptian society, and it will probably have its day after being held down for quite some period of time. And it is a part of a scene in Egypt. One has to speculate what might come out of this in the future. In Egypt, why is it that Egypt is singled out as it seems to be in Daniel's prophecy? Will they become the leading nation of this period of time that the king of the south comes to around a figure and makes us push at the king of the north? We don't know for sure, but it's an interesting area to watch and to understand into the future. It could be coming out of this area. It could come out of Iran. The scriptures don't necessarily tell us exactly, but it is interesting that in Daniel 11, Egypt seems to be singled out in the way that it is. So when we look at this coming clash of civilizations, understand that it is something that is long, long developing from the very period of the Roman Empire in terms of clashes there between the king of the north and south as it was at that time. And as history has developed, particularly after the rise of Islam, there have been pushes in the past, and the Bible tells us there is one final push that is going to be made by the king of the south at the king of the north that is going to be a trigger event for these many events that are going to come forward and to be fulfilled in the time prior to Christ's second coming, as we see here in Daniel 11. This is a very significant event to understand from as it has developed and what and how and why it may develop in the future in terms of the development. Now, I want to conclude by taking you back to Daniel 11 or Daniel 12 and just looking very briefly at the first verses of the Daniel 12, because one of the keys of prophecy is to read on. It's important to understand some of these key events and try to figure out and at least watch and have a working knowledge of some of these things and for our understanding. But always read on in a prophecy and look to the next few verses, because God always gives a message and a measure of hope and a ray of light. Daniel 12 and verse 1 talks about the time when Michael will stand up, that great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. Michael is a powerful archangel that historic or from the biblical record stands over Israel and the people of God and is going to stand over them even at this time when there will be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation even to that time. And at that time your people shall be delivered. God's people are promised continually deliverance. And the deliverance that verse 1 speaks of, we should probably understand it ultimately. It is a deliverance from the power of Satan and certainly from the power of the second death. Whatever other deliverance God affords his people according to other promises, that God will to reveal and show in his own time. But there is the promise, ultimately, of deliverance and spiritual deliverance from the power of Satan and from the power of the second death, which means you will be a part of the family of God and his kingdom. Many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. I think this section once again brings prophecy back down to our level as to how we should live, how we should act, and the hope that God gives us. We are to be involved in a work of turning many to righteousness. That is the work that God has placed in our hands to preach the gospel of the coming kingdom of God. And to announce that and to give the hope of that kingdom of God in our time, in our way, with the means God has given to us, I think in fulfillment of this particular verse. Always read forward in prophecy. As we try to understand the various elements, remember that God always holds out a hope and a promise and a description of the work that we are to be involved in and that we are to be doing.